Chapter 52. Amanda. Dawn was a red promise in the sky as Amanda drained a glass of water that Thanksgiving morning. She wore a pair of shorts, sneakers, and a tee. It had been a late night. Cracking open her apartment door at 3 a.m., she had gone straight to bed. She'd slept fitfully, her mind racing. She felt tired and her knee ached. Sitting down at her kitchen table, Amanda counted the money she'd taken from Quinn's house the night before. Altogether, it was close to 75 grand, enough to solve her immediate problems. Opening the cupboard, she found a box of cereal, but there was no milk. Amanda wasn't hungry, but she knew she had to eat. There had to be something in her stomach before she could take any more painkillers for her knee. It had swollen again, and she'd taped a bag of ice to her leg. Amanda filled the bowl of cereal with water from the faucet, sat down and ate what she could while she worked at the laptop. She'd only skim-read most of the articles last night. There came a point when she was too tired to take them in. Her head was a little clearer now, and she took her time, looking through each one, making notes on a legal pad as she went. She read the piece on the original attack again, when Ruth had almost been murdered in her own home by a serial killer the police called Mr. Blue Eyes. The article contained a sketch artist's impression of the perpetrator. Looking at that sketch and the pictures of Travers, Quinn, and Benson, men who Ruth had arranged to be murdered, there was a definite resemblance. Now, in the daylight, feeling a little calmer and in familiar surroundings, Amanda looked more closely at the pictures of Travers, Quinn, and Benson. From a distance, it would be hard to distinguish between them, but up close, there were differences. Quinn was older than the other two, with deeper lines around the eyes. Benson had a higher hairline and a small scar on his cheek. Travers was paler than both. She did another search against the images, scrolled through the irrelevant pages until she hit another image of a man, remarkably similar to Travers, Benson, and Quinn. He'd been murdered in his home, stabbed to death. No apparent motive, no suspects. Nothing taken from the property. This had occurred 2 years ago. There was no way to be sure this was Ruth's work, but it could well have been. His name was Sean Gardner. He'd lived in East Harlem. She saved that article, added the man's image to her search, and found another. Paul Barriano, shot twice in the head at his front door in Queens. No motive, nothing taken from him or the house. A hit, but Barriano had no connection to organized crime. He was an Uber driver. Barriano had been murdered 3 months ago. Adding his image to the search, she tried again. Two more motiveless murders, older crimes. Two more men with a striking similarity to the other victims. One was named Paul Anderson, an interior designer. The other was the earliest victim Amanda could identify, Dan Puccini, the media relations manager for the NYPD. Anderson died a year after Puccini. With all of the images of the victims together, side by side, it looked like one hell of an ID parade. Six men murdered in different parts of New York since Ruth's release from Kirby Psychiatric Center. There would be six different police precincts working these crimes, and nothing to connect the victims other than their faces. Dan Puccini had been murdered 6 months after Ruth got released from Kirby. Then the next one, about a year afterwards, with Anderson. And then the murders had accelerated. 9 months later, 8 months later, 6 months, and then just 3 months before Quinn. There was no way to tell if these were all Ruth's victims. She knew there were definitely two, at least, Quinn and Benson, and the original victim, Patrick Travers. And yet there was no way to prove or confirm any of them other than Travers, because she'd probably had someone else carry out each of these murders. Each victim had another victim behind them, the bereaved, half-crazed person who was at the end of their rope when Ruth came into their lives with a plan for justice. Amanda covered her mouth, swore under her breath. She had been one of Ruth Gelman's grim reapers, conned into killing for her. At first, having read the article on Ruth's attack, she had felt sorry for her. Now, she felt afraid. Glancing up at the bookcase, she took down a thick volume she had read a few months ago. It was a book by a forensic psychologist on serial killers. She had read it trying to gain some insight into Wallace Crone. Perhaps she could learn something she could use against him. In the end, she had not. But she knew more about how some of these freaks come to be, how they kill, and more importantly, how they get caught. She had learned that most of them aren't insane, which was the first thing that surprised her. Some are disorganized, some are highly organized, and they can hide in plain sight, just like any other normal member of society. Flicking through the book, she found one of the pages where she had turned down the corner to mark it as potentially important. Serial killers are most vulnerable to apprehension by law enforcement when they are at the high point of a pattern of accelerating crisis, which we examine below. Yet these patterns of accelerating crisis are not present in all serial murderers. Expert opinion is divided, but some leading psychologists, law enforcement specialists, and criminologists believe there is another type of killer who follows no pattern. They are highly organized, they have no innate psychological trauma, no hallucinations, no psychosis whatsoever. They do not fall into any category of the current or past DSM, and therefore have no clinical mental illness of any kind. In short, they kill whomever they please, whenever they please, at random. They are the great white sharks of the human species. Amanda shuddered, skipped two paragraphs, and began reading again. Often with serial killers, there will come a time of crisis when they are most vulnerable to apprehension by law enforcement. These crimes often follow a pattern, particularly with perpetrators who experience some form of psychosis, be it visual or auditory hallucinations. The pattern is cyclical for serial murder. First, the perpetrator fantasizes about the murder, sometimes for long periods of time. Then, a victim is selected and stalked. Again, the length of time involved can vary, and this stalking period can take months or years. This builds up to the moment they take action and gain fulfillment from the crime. The memory and experience of the murder becomes a realization of the fantasy, and that is enough for them in the beginning. Some killers never move on after this, but some do. As the heightened experience of the murder diminishes, the cycle begins again. What emerges is a continuous spiral of murder, whereas the pattern continues, the cycle accelerates. And while every murder delivers a sense of pleasure and climax to the serial killer, it is also traumatizing, even though they don't experience it in this way. It actually deepens and heightens their psychosis, helping to create the state of crisis. This has been observed in numerous cases. Jeffrey Dahmer, for example. There was a break of 9 years between his first and second victim. Then it accelerated to 1 a year and got faster still. At the time of his arrest, he had killed 4 men in the space of 3 weeks and was in a state of traumatic crisis. Amanda put the book down. She was no psychologist, but whichever way you looked at it, Ruth was doing this with greater frequency. She picked up the phone to call Billy and walked into the bedroom to see if she had anything to wear. That's when she remembered there was still a black garbage bag of clothes in the bathroom. They had bloodstains on them, Quinn's blood. And in among them was the second burner phone. She had to get rid of it right now. Throwing on some sweats, she grabbed the bag and her smokes. She took the elevator down, went through the small lobby and out onto the street. Fishing the pack out of her pocket, she lit one and smoked while she walked. 4 blocks up and on the right was an alley with dumpsters. It was a quiet morning with few people on the streets. It would be a little busier later with the parade, she guessed. With any luck, no one would see her dump the bag. She made it to the alley, but the gate was drawn across it, locked. There was an alley beside her building. It wasn't ideal, but it would have to do. She couldn't walk the streets with the bag, too many cameras. She turned and headed back to her building, then stopped 20 feet from the entrance. Detective Farrow exited her building. He took out his cell phone and began flicking his finger across the screen. Amanda slowly backed away. A 24-hour laundromat was on her right. Those places never close, not even on Thanksgiving. She pushed the door and it opened. She went inside. Two people were in there, a little way from the door towards the back, staring at their phones. Amanda stayed by the window, keeping Pharaoh in sight. Then, her cell phone began to vibrate in her pocket. She took it out, stared at the screen. Pharaoh was calling her. He stood in the middle of the street, the phone at his ear. Amanda held her cell in her hand. She'd known the cops would come for her once they'd connected her to the Quinn murder, probably with her DNA. She just hadn't expected it to be so soon. She'd been sure she'd have at least another day, maybe two. Pharaoh and Hernandez were working the Quinn case. She knew that all too well. He was here to arrest her. If he wanted to check in on her, he would pick up the phone. He never came to her apartment unannounced. Her thumb hovered over the green circle with the picture of an old-style telephone in the center. She looked up at him, trying to read his body language. He was facing away from her, so she couldn't see his expression. It was a little noisy in the laundromat. A couple of the big industrial dryers were going, and the radio played over the top. If she answered, Pharaoh might hear the dryers. He might turn round and see her. She let the call go to voicemail, safer that way. Pharaoh talked. She couldn't hear what he said, but she saw his jaw working. Then he looked at the phone, ended the call, and put it back in his jacket. He made his way across the street to his car, got in. He didn't drive away. Amanda hunkered down in the window, making herself small in case he saw her. She had a bag of bloody clothes in her hand from the attempted murder case he was investigating. On no account could he see her. She wondered if she could sneak out the front door and make it back to her apartment without him noticing. Moving closer to the front door, she kept her eyes on him as he sat behind the wheel of the car. He faced forward. Taking hold of the door handle, she began to pull it down. Pharaoh's head swung round, back in the direction of her building, and Amanda ducked, hiding behind a change dispenser. She waited, afraid to move. Glancing behind her, she saw the two people in the laundromat still on their phones, taking no notice. She stepped back, took a seat on the end of the bench that divided the room, sat up straight. She could just see over the bank of coin machines and the small counter at the front of the window. The top of Pharaoh's car was visible. She inched off the seat, checked to make sure he was still behind the wheel. And he was, thank God. After 10 minutes, he still hadn't driven off. He was waiting for her, watching the entrance. Amanda knew then she had run out of time. She needed to make herself disappear and find Naomi as soon as possible. But the money she'd taken from Quinn's lockbox was in her apartment, with her laptop. She needed all of it. Amanda turned and looked to see if there was a rear exit to the laundromat. As she did, she took out her cell, dialed into her voicemail, and put the phone to her ear.